You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is consumer technology reporter for Bloomberg, Mark Gurman. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I like your intro music.
Oh, cool. Thank you. And I like having you on the show. I've been following you for years. It's finally great to meet you in person. This is such a fun show because I get to meet so many interesting people. You are currently a technical journalist covering Apple and other high-tech companies for Bloomberg. You're probably the most well-known writer in our community for your ability to dig in, find stuff and documents, develop sources, and even predict new Apple products and announcements. Wow, that's amazing. But this is background mode, and we dig into the background of the guest a little. So how did you know you wanted to get into this kind of thing? How old were you? What were your earliest memories of getting into all of this?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the compliments. That's very kind of you. I don't necessarily look at myself that way, but it's nice to hear that coming from someone of your stature. But diving into your question, I've always been interested in technology. I remember playing on the computer. I had a Compaq PC for many years. I don't remember what age I got a Mac, but it was when I was a little bit younger. And I remember an iPod Mini for, I think it was my 10th birthday at that point. I think I had the blue one. My brother got the green one. And this was the iPod Mini. That was a pretty popular device back in the day when it came out. That was a really big deal. It was like the hit technology product at the time. Now we look back and look how far we've come to iPhones and Samsung Galaxies.
Oh, yeah. Some people say that Apple couldn't have created the iPhone unless they did the iPod first.
Yeah, you know, that's probably true in terms of the miniaturization that went into the iPod that they transferred over to the iPhone. But back to your question, always been interested in technology, and I felt that it was a natural evolution to jump into, you know, learning more about the company that I liked so much independently and then reporting on it for
many
years.
How old were you at the time?
When I started.
When you started with the iPod.
No. Probably about 10 years old when I got an iPod, I would say.
Did you
right in the middle of the iPod's heyday. Yeah.
Did you have a Mac too? Did that come soon?
Yeah, I think I got a iBook G4 when it was time to get a computer for school. They were pushing hard to, you know, get laptops and such, and the G4 iBook was my first one.
Many of us who are immersed in computer technology when we're young have an alternate ambition. It's not crystallized yet. So I've run across people who wanted to be, you know, lawyers or writers or pilots or astronauts at that age and then fell into computer technology and then it kind of grasped them and fixated them. Did you have any aspirations to be something different at that age?
Never. I always wanted to play in the technology world, products in that space. For a period of time, I actually was an iPhone app developer. This was in the really early days of the iPhone. I made some fun little apps. They weren't very productive to the user, but I thought it was cool to experience, you know, teaching myself how to code, the process of putting applications together and then marketing them and selling them. That was an interesting point.
What role did your parents play? Were they technical and encourage you?
You know, my parents were always and still are all about, you know, my brother and I and were their lives, and we work together as a team. We're a tight-knit group, the four of us, and always encouraging and letting us push ourselves and giving us the opportunity and the bandwidth to do whatever we wanted, not pushing us. You know, there's families where someone might say, oh, you know, you have to grow up to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. But my parents were very much in the camp that my brother and I should do exactly what we wanted to do because they weren't afforded that opportunity when they grew up.
So then roughly in high school, as I recall, you started writing for 9to5 Mac.
Yeah, that's right. In about right around the launch of the iPad, the first one. So late 09, early 2010 is when I got my start.
How did you do that? I mean, did you just call the editor one day and say, I want to write for you? How did you manage that?
You know, Seth Weintraub and I, he's the owner of 9to5 Mac, Google, Electrek, 9to5 Toys, and a couple other sites. still to this day an excellent friend of mine. We developed a really close bond over the many years that we worked together, and still keep in touch regularly. But, you know, we started speaking after I was sort of digging into Apple's plans for the iPad, the tablet at the time. And it was a natural progression for me to start writing out a little bit for free at 9 to 5 at the time, just, you know, for the early part of my work there, just, you know.
So you did some digging on the iPad, and you then encountered Seth and showed him what you were doing, and he was impressed, and he said, "Well, yeah, why don't you write some stuff for us?"
And it went from there. Exactly. Couldn't have said it better.
Cool.
And here we are.
And here we are. Has Seth continued to be a mentor of yours?
You know, Seth and I have always been really good friends, and I think we've learned a lot from each other, and we grew together, I think, in some ways, and really, you know, with Seth's leadership, turned 9to5Mac into the best Apple news site on the web today. So,
what was it that dragged you into the Apple sphere? Was it
the dedicated iPod? Apple news site, I'll say.
Okay. Was the iPod the trigger? The thing that sort of lit you up about Apple coolness and technology, or was it the Mac, or how did that work out?
You know, I don't remember at the time, but I think I was particularly fascinated with the iMac, being able to cram everything in behind the screen itself. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like the prototypical Apple product, something that hasn't really been done before or done well before. And, you know, you look back, it's not that thin of a device. It's pretty thick. I still have an iMac G5 on my floor in my closet.
Yeah, iMac G5. Power PC, huh?
Yes, Power PC. I think that was a 20-inch at the time, right?
Where does the Power PC peak in terms of Mac OS? Isn't there the latest thing you can put on a Power PC is something like Lion?
That's a good question. I don't remember. It might have been Leopard. Maybe. Because I remember Leopard came out in 2007. It might have been Leopard. Leopard or Snow Leopard. But maybe Lion. Yeah. Who knows at this point? That's so far, you know, far removed. But those were interesting times between 2005 and 2008.
Let me ask you, did there come a time when you started realizing that you had this special ability at digging in and finding stuff other people couldn't find, and then you got sort of fixed on it because Apple was so secretive? Did that sort of create an allure for you?
You know, I don't look at anything I do as a special ability. It's just what I'm interested in doing. I don't really, you know, take the time to compare myself to others. I think that's a waste of my brain bandwith and time.
Well, you're being very modest because you're quite talented.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But to be honest, my focus almost entirely is just making sure, you know, we get the next story wherever I'm at. It's always a team effort. Here, it's about Bloomberg. Before, it was about 9to5Mac. It's not about me in any way.
When you were at 9to5Mac, that was when you were doing a very good job of developing some sources. I don't want to get into the details of that or names, of course, anything like that. But what was it that allowed you to develop these sources so well? Was it an innate curiosity? Was it eagerness to pick up the phone and call people? How did you do that?
You know, I think the curiosity still to this day has always been very key in terms of my work. If you're not personally interested and curious about it and knowledgeable about the product structure and what's going on at Apple and what they may be coming up with down the road, you know, it makes it difficult to do it because the motivation is not innate. If you have the innate motivation to want to know what's next, like I did and still have to this day, that makes it a little bit easier.
Cool. I wanted to ask you, now you're at Bloomberg. Tell me about that transition. Did someone at Bloomberg come and try to grab you and lobby to get you moved over? How did that happen?
You know, Bloomberg is an incredible organization. It's a huge company, amazing resources, and just the talent that we have on the tech team here. I really think that everyone is the best in their field. right? Like the person who covers Google and startups and electric cars and obviously Apple and the chip makers and enterprise. I just think everyone is so fantastic in what they do, in the TV presence and the digital resources, and of course the leadership of Brad Stone, who's in charge of the team. It's just great, end to end. So it was really a no-brainer transition for me.
Did you approach Brad and suggest coming on board?
I'm not going to get into the idiosyncrasies and the details of the transition.
Okay.
But I will say, Bloomberg is my first choice. I love it here. And I love my time at 9to5Mac. So
I wanted to ask you one more thing about your background, and that was the University of Michigan.
That's right.
Did you go to the University of Michigan as a journalism major?
No. After I graduated high school, I went to Michigan for this program called the School of Information. So it's a program that mixes entrepreneurship, which I had a minor in, and like technology, programming, interface design, and sort of marketing and business, like roping everything together into one program. Lots of design classes, user interface design, general software design, wireless networking, types of things like the packets and the data sets that go into all that, statistics and different math classes. So looping that all into one program. It's called the School of Information, SI for short. And I enjoyed my time in that program.
Cool. How did you feel after you graduated? Did you feel like, you really arrived, that you had all the tools and all the education you needed, kind of punctuate what you had been doing?
I've been doing this line of work since high school. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that anything that I particularly did in high school or college created this result of my work. I think that I wouldn't have really ended up anywhere different had I gone to Michigan or not, or that major. What I will say, though, is that, the writing and the deadlines and everything that you have to do as a college student, that's what really prepares you for life after college. It's not the specific courses or classes or knowledge, but it's like the general work attitude, the general writing practice, mm-hmm. meeting the work deadlines, the group projects, learning how to collaborate. I think those were the biggest pieces that I took out of college for sure.
I agree with you. I often talk about how it affected me and how work in physics and writing sort of creates that sense of timeliness and discipline, accuracy and professionalism that you just can't get anywhere else. I agree with you. It's absolutely true.
College is an invaluable experience. I love my time there, and it's great preparation for what people call the real world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's an interesting background. Thank you for sharing.
No, thank you.
And it's time for a break. I think we're done there. And in part two, I want to ask you about all sorts of Apple geeky stuff. And HomePod and Macs and Apple TV and stuff. But first, I'm going to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds with Mark Gurman.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm chatting with Bloomberg technology reporter Mark Gurman. Mark, so I am going to take the opportunity to pick your brain in this second half. I have a list of what I think are some interesting and timely questions I want to hear your opinions about.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So let's kind of just like work our way through and have some fun. The first one on my list is back around December or so of 2016. You wrote a very interesting article to me about Macintosh, about the Macintosh team at Apple. The Macintosh is my first love, and I thought that was a very interesting article. And the short version of it, and I'll let you elaborate, is that the Macintosh team got into some disarray, and that's what stretched out the product shipments. What do you think really went wrong in Apple, and how do you think Apple reignited the Mac at WWDC a couple months ago?
Yeah, first of all, I appreciate you bringing up that article. A lot of work went into that. I'm glad we were able to get it out. WWDC, sort of, they hit the reset button, right? They had updates to the MacBook 12-inch, the MacBook Pro, and even the MacBook Air, which I reported earlier in the months before that Apple was planning to update the MacBook Air. Again, I got a lot of negative feedback on that, people saying there's no way that's true, but you know, it happens. So MacBook Air as well, iMac updates. They also previewed the iMac Pro coming out in December. And I think, I mean, I would assume they pushed up the release of the iMac Pro to try to get it, you know, out the door in 2017 earlier than they would have anticipated, given that people were complaining for years, if not several months, about the Mac being in disarray, the updates not being what professionals are looking for. There was sort of this, and I think we explained this really well in the story. Apple was becoming this company focusing on thin mobile devices like the iPad, the iPhone, and the Apple Watch. And those are their consumer devices, right? But when they were positioning towards making those devices better, they wanted to spread the thin and light factor and the design over performance, you know, understanding of products to the Macs as well. That's why you see the MacBook Air, you see the ultra thin MacBook Pro that compromises on stuff in order to fit in the touch bar and the larger trackpad and all that. So they were sort of moving away from what professionals need and require from a desktop or laptop device because they wanted to bring this iPad design acumen to the rest of the line. But I think what we saw at WWDC is they're sort of moving back in the other direction. And understanding, fine, there's people who want a Mac that's as thin as an iPad like the MacBook and MacBook Air, but there's also people who want something a little bit higher performance. So they updated the MacBook Pro 6 months or so, 8 months after the previous one, which was a fast update timeline for Apple in terms of comparing to what they were doing in the previous few years. Back in the day, they used to update these things, what, every 3 to 6 to 9 months?
Yeah.
Now it seems like they're starting to more frequently update the Macs, but they also previewed this iMac Pro. It's $5,000. It's super expensive, but it answers the question, what kind of computer can Apple make for its most professional users?
Halo Mac.
That's right. That's right. And that's what the Mac Pro was supposed to be, right? The Mac that would halo over the rest of the line back in 2013. But that, I mean, I won't say that was a failure, but that had a lot of compromises. That was the most consumerized, iPhone-ized, iPad-ized version of for a high-end professional computer. And that's probably why it hasn't seen a true meaningful
update. I'm talking
to
you on one of those. I have a Mac Pro 2013 sitting right here.
And it looks awesome.
For me, as a writer, it's glorious. But I understand the problems for technical professionals. Do you think the Microsoft Studio that was announced back in October was a wake-up call?
You know, they deny that. They don't think that was, you know, a remarkable launch, and you can see that based, and they're not really copying that or doing anything in that direction. So I don't know if it was a wake-up call to Apple necessarily, but it might have been a wake-up call to, you know, the surrounding industry, the customers saying, Apple is not the only company now that can produce high-end hardware, right? There was a time where, like, if you need to look back to 2013, great, this Mac Pro is not what professionals need, right? But you look at the marketplace back in 2013, 2014, 2015, even, you say, fine, it's not what we need, but is there anything better? Is there anything even comparable? The answer was no. Now, Microsoft, in terms of a consumer hardware maker, they're making great stuff these days. I tested the Surface laptop. I personally like it. I think if you have $1,000 to spend on a laptop and you have to cap at $1,000 as your base price, You compare that thing to the MacBook Air, it's a no-brainer to get the Surface laptop instead of the MacBook Air. But if you spend
if you're willing to suffer through Windows 10.
Well, I mean, in your definition, it's suffering. Maybe in my definition, but you know, there's a lot of people who are cool with it, right? Yeah. And it's a good machine for the price. If you're willing to spend a few hundred dollars more, you might be able to get something much better from Apple. But if we're talking about at that price point, apples to apples, I think the Surface laptop over the MacBook Air is a good get.
Interesting. Okay, next item. It looks like from what we've been hearing from Ming-Chao Kuo and others, that Apple's going to include an LTE radio system in the Apple Watch Series 3. You mentioned that in an interview.
I hate to interrupt you, but that was actually our story at Bloomberg. We broke that, not
so you were the first. You know, it bounded around the echo chamber with so much energy that I couldn't track down where it first came from. No doubt it was you.
I wouldn't normally, shout out and say that was us, but we're really proud of that story, and it did really well.
You mentioned in that interview that video interview that it remains to be seen if you can make a conventional phone call over that LTE system, but it certainly does open the door to apps like Skype and things like that, does it not?
I think that's the limit we're going to see, maybe even FaceTime audio, but I think just like you weren't able to make FaceTime calls over cellular networks until a few years after the iPhone 4 came out, there might be some limitations on what you can do with LTE on the Apple Watch. And remember, phone calls are one of the biggest battery drainers on the LTE chipsets in the iPhone or any other phone. It doesn't matter if it's an Apple or a Samsung. So I think including call functionality on that LTE radio in such a small device could be detrimental to the product's battery life. But we'll see. In my opinion, I think it's going to be like an iPad play, right? You can buy an LTE LTE iPad right now, hook it up to your phone account for between $10 to $20 per month, get all the LTE data access on that shared pool of data on the iPad when you're not using your phone. But you can't make regular phone calls from it, but you could pretty much do everything else.
There's been some rumors about a change of form factor. I don't know if that was you or John Gruber, but I've been arguing at TMO that the Apple Watch can't get much thinner because it really makes a big difference in the battery and all these new things that it wants to do. So what do you think about change in form factor, but maybe not any thinner? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I don't really believe the hype on the significant form factor change. I mean, it's been since they introduced this current design in 2014. So whenever this comes out in the fall, that would be around 3 years since introducing this current form factor. So obviously they have to change it a little bit somehow, some way, but combined with trying to retain that battery life while integrating an LTE radio and the additional functionality and horsepower they'll need for watchOS 4, mm-hmm. I can't imagine they'll be able to slim it down much.
Well, you and I agree exactly on that. I've been telling Brian Chaffin here at the Mac Observer about that, and he keeps saying, no, it's going to get thinner, it's going to be cooler. I'm going, no. It's iconic. First of all, it's iconic, and second of all, it needs that thickness for the battery. So,
maybe there'll be non-LTE models that are considerably thinner. You know, it's possible they'll have a thin and a thick, one LTE, one no radio.
That's a good thought. Okay, next. What are you thinking about this now-revealed Mac Pro for 2018? I'm in a quandary about the pricing because it'll be more modular. It won't have a display, which is probably worth $800-$900. Do you think that because of the modularity and lack of display, it's going to come in less than $49.95 on a base price, or do you think it's going to be so exotic and so fast and so super computerish that it's even going to be more than the $49.95 of an iMac Pro?
You know, that's a very good question. I think from a marketing perspective, I believe you worked in marketing, right? At Apple?
Yes.
That was
yes.
So from a marketing perspective, they're going to want to have the Mac Pro as the highest end device or computer they sell. And price points talk, right? Price points indicate how high-end something is, in Apple parlance at least. So I think it would be hard for them to price this Mac Pro at under the price of the iMac Pro, which is $5,000. So this is what I'm thinking. I'm thinking they cost the same. One, on the iMac Pro, $5,000, you get the benefit of the screen and really fast performance. The Mac Pro, you get modularity, like you said, and even faster performance, but no screen. So you choose one direction, right? You choose your compromise, and you pay the same for the base price.
Interesting. I was hoping that I could probably get one for less than $5,000, but maybe that's just a pipe dream. Oh, my. Well,
I mean, we'll see. The other way to look at it is the Mac Pro is much cheaper, and it's still more powerful than the iMac Pro. But why is it cheaper? Because it doesn't have the 5K display in there. But we'll have to see. We'll know in a year.
That'll be an interesting decision by Apple. Okay, so next. You recently wrote about how devious Apple's getting in foiling the trademark sleuths. That was just a week ago. Great article again. Do you
think
that's symptomatic of a tightening across the board? Are you feeling a tightening across the board, or do you think that was just one shot kind of thing that they needed to do?
So this trademark thing is very interesting. It spans back to the 1800s. There's this treaty which basically says if you register for a trademark in one country that's part of this treaty, and there's almost 200 as part of this, you get the registration in any other country that's part of that pack of 200. So the way it works is theoretically Apple could trademark the name of the next iPhone in June in Jamaica. I believe that's the example we had in the story. Mm-hmm. And they could get priority on it when they register it after the phone is announced in September. And registering for priorities is very important because there's people out there who, just like, they try to buy domain names so they can sell it to you later if they think it's one you'll want. People do the same thing with trademarks. Remember, there was the whole iPhone name trademark situation with Cisco back in 2007, if you recall that. Listeners recall that. That was a big deal at the time, and the two companies ended up settling outside of court. I believe there was some cross-licensing deal, maybe some money paid on one end. I'm not entirely sure. But trademarking avoids that, right? And so what Apple's trying to do now is make sure that people aren't able to pull up their trademarks early so they could try to fight that priority registration. And this is industry-wide, right? Amazon, Google, Microsoft all use the same tactics. So what they've done here is they discovered some people are just always going to Jamaica to look at the next Apple product trademarks, because the majority of pre-registration trademarks for future Apple product names over the last 5 to 10 years have been in Jamaica. So Apple is now moving around to the 60, 70 or so other countries that are part of the 200 that don't have online search databases. If you don't have an online search database, you have to fly to that country to find the name of the trademark database, which, and I agree, it's going to be much more difficult now. You're not going to want to fly between 60 different countries to try to find the name of the next iPhone. Yeah. I certainly don't have that kind of time, and I don't think the trademarks lose too either.
Is it your surmise that it's going to be iPhone 8? We seem to have settled on that. What do you think?
You know, it's possible. It could be iPhone 8. It could be iPhone X. It could just be iPhone. I think it's anyone's guess at this point. I'll be interested to see if they call the other two models the 8 and the 8 Plus, or the 7S and the 7S Plus. Yeah. If they call them the 7S and 7S Plus, I think you could say that the redesigned one will be the 8. But what if they call the other two 8 and 8 Plus, and they, you know, make the this one the iPhone Pro or the 8 Pro or the...
Or the iPhone X, which is kind of cool because it's the 10th anniversary.
Yeah, no, it's very possible. There's a lot of different directions they can go, and I think that'll be one of the more interesting announcements next month.
Okay, I want to ask you next about robots. Tim Cook has said a lot of things obliquely about autonomous cars, about Apple's interest in TV, about his enthusiasm for augmented reality, but we've never heard Tim Cook, I never have, say anything whatsoever about family service robots of any kind. Maybe obliquely in the last earnings report when he talked about this, other things autonomous things can do. And, you know, he may in the back of his head be suppressing thoughts about autonomous droids in family service form. But I've never heard him talk about robots or androids in any shape or fashion. But other companies seem to think there's a market there for building these little devices that are friendly and can do services and talk to your kids and do various things. Do you think Apple has an interest in getting into that down the road because of their expertise in so many areas?
I don't personally, but I mean, one thing that people should understand is that Apple has its hardware that you can buy, right? It's consumer hardware, Macs, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches, headphones, and Apple TVs and whatnot. But there's a whole other world out there of Apple hardware. It's Apple hardware that they use to design the hardware that they sell. It's the Apple hardware that they use for maps, data collection, building products, and manufacturing. And there's a lot of autonomy work and drones and stuff like that, AI that goes into building robots and machines that Apple uses for its own internal processes. I think a few years ago they showed off this robot called Liam that uses, you know, AI and robotic arms to tear apart iPhones that come into, you know, Apple Care support centers or recycling and whatnot. So there's a lot of autonomy work that goes into the products that you don't see on the shelves at Apple stores or Best Buy.
Interesting. Yeah, that would certainly be an application. Do you think Apple strategically might suffer down the road when the robots and droids of science fiction come into reality?
I don't know if they are going to become reality. I don't know if that will be a reality. We'll see. Apple traditionally isn't, you know, first to introducing us to a new reality, aside from the iPhone and the Mac. The last few product cycles, they sort of come in a little bit after other people. I think one thing that Apple has missed, and this might have been a big miss, was voice. They did have Siri first. They were first to a consumer mass adopted voice service with Siri with the iPhone 4S in 2011. But man, Alexa, Amazon, what they've been doing there with the home speakers and all that, that has really caused market penetration of these voice services and commercialized and popularized, like, you know, like Apple has not able to have done with Siri until, you know, and they haven't done it yet. And we'll see what happens when the HomePod comes out in December.
Yeah, that fits into my very next question, actually. It's the HomePod. When the HomePod first came out, it seemed to me that Apple was a little bit reluctant to kind of go toe-to-toe with Amazon, the kind of the product that needs to be in every room, that there's some security issues with the Echo, that his feeling, and he said it, Tim Cook said it, that, you know, Siri's always with you in your Apple Watch and your iPhone. How are you feeling about the strategic move of building this HomePod? Is it sort of like putting your toes in the water of the smart speaker without doing it?
You know, I just don't think Siri and their services and the way they can present data via voice and speakers is good enough yet to straight up just say this is a Siri device. I think that's one of the reasons that they're positioning it around the HomePod being the audio speaker for Apple Music. We'll see down the road if there's a shift. If you remember, the Apple Watch has seen this ginormous shift from a fashion tech iPhone on your wrist type of device to a fitness tracking device with Siri and notifications and whatnot. So they have not been afraid to make major marketing shifts in terms of how they present products. So I'm certain they'll be open to doing that again. And if you think about it, the HomePod, I mean, you can call it a loudspeaker for Apple Music as a primary function, or you can call it a Siri speaker as its primary function. And that's just billboards, right? That's just billboards and TV ads, because the product itself technologically doesn't have to change from its current, you know, the way it currently works. You can call it either of the two and be correct.
Okay. So we're starting to run out of time. I just have time for a couple more questions. One of the things that's been on my mind is the price of this iPhone 8 or iPhone X. A fellow at IHS told me a few months ago that OLED displays in the 5-inch range are about the same OEM price as the LCD displays. There's not a big difference. But people seem to be in the echo chamber climbing onto this idea that it's going to cost $1,000, then $1,200, then $1,400, then $1,500. Have you been watching? I'm sure you've been watching that ever-increasing rumored price. What do you think of all that?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of, smoke for there not to be fire. If you look at the strategy that they're going to be doing this year, coming up with the 7S device, 7S Plus device, and then this higher-end device, they're not going to lower the price of the main phones, the 7S and the 7S Plus. So obviously the 8, the revamp one, is going to have to be a bit more expensive. Mm-hmm. And if you already look at the most expensive 7 Plus with 256 gigabytes and you get the jet black model, that's already $970. So I think passing that $1,000 threshold is absolutely going to happen. I think there's no doubt about that, at least for the next 1,500.
Yeah. I can't see 1,500.
You know, if they price this thing at 1,500, it would just be a little weird, embarrassing when the margins are run by, I think you mentioned IHS, because a phone with what, a 70, 80% margin value, yeah. 1,500 is way too much. I mean, you think about how much it costs to build. And I don't think Apple has ever been, you know, outrageous on its iOS devices in terms of margins to that extreme. Right. Will it be more expensive? Will it be over $1,000? Yes. But I don't see it reaching $1,500 even with the most storage, unless they're putting, you know, some gold thing around the edges, yeah. Which is not going to happen. So.
Okay. So one more question.
One more thing I want to add.
Sure.
I mean, these rumors and news of the $1,500 price point being spread around, if it is indeed not true, don't you think that maybe when it gets announced as maybe being $1,000 or $1,100, it might be like, whoa, that's a good price because it's not $1,500.
I think it's clickbait. I think the number keeps rising for clickbait value, actually.
Well, you had a story about this, about the consumer reaction to the price of the iPad back in 2010, didn't you? Versus the expectations of $1,000.
Maybe.
A long time ago.
Maybe.
Yeah.
All right. So I wanted to ask you finally, what's it like at Bloomberg? Do you feel like you have more clout and more resources? Is it, and is there more pressure on you than there was at 9to5 Mac?
You know, this statement is for both 9to5 Mac and Bloomberg. I don't think anyone could put more pressure on me than I already put on myself. So I don't feel any outside pressure. I never really have. I'm totally, you know, enclosed in my own work, looking to get the next big story. The main difference between Bloomberg and 9to5 Mac is that 9to5 Mac was extremely Apple focused, obviously with the electric car site and the Google site. But here I sort of jumped in and I'm doing news on hardware from the other big players now. And also there's been a shift since I started at Bloomberg, which is just over a year ago. You've seen the shift of other technology players jumping into the market. So when I was at 9to5 Mac throughout my history there, Apple was the consumer tech story. Apple was the consumer hardware player of the generation. But now you see Amazon bulking up. You see Google jumping into hardware last year. Google Pixel. Facebook is going to be entering consumer hardware next year with their video conferencing system. You can read our story on that. Oculus is jumping into consumer-grade, consumer-priced hardware with its VR headset for $200 in the beginning of next year. So the sea change of the technology industry and consumer hardware has actually changed around me and changed around these websites to a point where this progression of going to Bloomberg made more sense for me.
Interesting. Great perspectives. Well, we are out of time now, and we're going to have to leave it at that. Thank you for responding to my list of questions. It was fascinating to hear your views on all that.
Thank you for having me. I truly appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Yeah, so you can read my work on Bloomberg.com/technology, or you can reach me on Twitter at twitter.com/MarkGurman, or read my work at Bloomberg.com/technology. And also be sure to check out Gadgets with Gurman, our new video series about new products each week. It's at Wednesday at 12:30 Pacific time, 3:30 Eastern time.
Excellent. I'll put that in the show notes as well. All right. Well, thank you again. I appreciate it. It was fun to finally meet you sort of like in person, if you can call it that.
Sure. Folks, let's do it again sometime.
Yes. Folks, thank you for joining us on the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you next week.